Question of what's going on. It's amazing.
Yeah, one of the rooms is also about his erotic works.
Yes.
Where'd that come from?
That came from the fact that he wanted to break all the barriers. Yeah. He's the first one. For example, he did self-portraits of himself naked.
Yeah.
Said a lot. And very often he showed important people naked from the waist up.
Yeah.
And you could see them with their hands like this. And it's amazing.
When did you buy your first piece?
When I was 14.
Is that right?
Yeah.
It just attracted to you the idea of...
Well, what happened was when I was 13 and a half, I went into a bookstore on Lexington Avenue called EY.
Yeah.
And I was looking for Toulouse-Lautrec, who I was interested in at that time. And all of a sudden, I saw Egon Schiele. And I took the book out and I started looking through it. And I realized this person was very special. Mm. But at that time, nobody had Schiele. They didn't know it because most of them were in private collections. And all of a sudden, I found, finally, one Schiele drawing. And I purchased it. I think I paid $600 for it. Yeah. And frankly, years later, when I sold it, when I traded it, it ended out in the Leopold collection, which is one of the great collections in Vienna.
Oh, wow.
And it's fantastic. But my family looked at me and said, our son must be crazy. What is he buying these pictures for?
Have you ever wanted to paint?
I did paint.
You did?
Yes.
Did you stop or do you still paint?
I stopped.
Yeah. Why did you stop? Because you knew too much?
Frankly, I could never compete.
Yeah, exactly.
When I saw it, I knew too much, right. And also, in order to paint, I believe, or to any artist, you have to have a certain fire in your stomach.
Yeah.
And I had more of a fire in my stomach to buy great art than I did.
And you were consumed by politics and business and other things as well.
Yeah. Business came later.
Yeah.
Politics came sooner.
All right. Let me take a look at some of these here. We've got some I want to show you, and then we'll come back to more about the artist. This one is the first image is a portrait of Goethe Schiele. This is 1909. Right?
Yes.
Heavily influenced by Klimt's.
Right.
Adele Bloch Bauer. Here it is. Tell me about it.
This picture of Goethe Schiele, you can see the influence of Gustav Klimt, particularly around her waist and the bottom there, the multicolored. But yet, at the same time, Schiele was starting to become his own person. And with the use of the hand, you can just see a little bit of it there. It shows his own influence and using the black around the back to make it stand out. You can see how special it was.
Okay, the next one is a portrait of Dr. Erwin von Graff, 1910.
This is a picture of Dr. von Graff was a gynecologist. And frankly, this picture usually hangs in my home in the sense that it's a powerful picture. You can see his hands, his red face almost, and the angst there.
It is said that he painted this in return for an abortion for one of his many mistresses.
I think whoever gave the information is very well informed.
Yeah.
This is a picture, though. Again, this is the story. We're not sure if it's true or not, but it sounds good.
Yeah. All right, the next one is a self-portrait with arm twisted above head. This is 1910.
Now
many say portraits, which he did.
This is self-portrait. You can see he was very inhibited, very shy, didn't want to really get out there and be in society.
Yeah.
But here he is. He's naked.
Yeah.
And with his hand by hand. And look at the pose. The pose is so unique, especially for that time.
Yeah.
And people didn't do portraits like that.
He was breaking new ground.
Breaking new ground.
Yeah. Even one of masturbation, didn't he make?
Yes, he did all kinds of things. And one of the things we have in our Neue Gallery is a limit to who can come in. It's one of the few museums where you have to be over a certain age.
Next is Wally in a red blouse. This is 1913, a portrait of one of his many serious lovers.
And now he's changing slightly. He's getting away from the 1910 sort of powerful pictures, but he's much more subtle now. But yet it has the same sexual part of it. And we're not sure. We think she was literally lying on the floor with her legs up like this.
Yes.
And he used this piece more and more. But it's a very, you can just feel this slight eroticism in the face.
Yeah. Okay, the next one is Portrait of the Artist's Wife. This is considered a masterpiece. It's 1915.
All right, now here is a painting that was never shown in the United States.
Yeah.
And the really leaves where it was in Europe. And you can see the use of colors, but also here's a portrait where he's gotten softer, but yet the way the portrait's done is so unique because the way the dress looks.
Yeah. I love the colors in the dress.
That's fantastic.
Then the family is in 1918. This was the year he died.
Right.
It depicts him and his wife and their unborn child.
Right. His wife was, I think, 6 months pregnant, and she died, and he died 2 or 3 days later. And the shame
all of Spanish flu?
All of Spanish flu. The shame was, this was the time he was just starting to be recognized.
At 28 years old.
28 years old. And again, he's changing his style a little bit. It's become more sensitive in a different way. But yet it still has the eroticism of his wife naked in front of him.
You paid $135 million for Adele Bloch Bauer.
To us, for the Neue Gallery, it's our Mona Lisa.
It is.
And people come from all over to see it. It's the most special painting I think we have in the Neue Gallery.
Is the most special painting you have?
Yes.
Ever? Yeah.
And in the Neue Gallery.
Yeah.
And the fact is that that is a landmark piece by a great artist, Gustav Klimt, at the height of his time. And there's almost nothing like it.
When you say that, what is it you think you see when you say this is the best of all the things here? This one is the best.
You look at his work.
Yeah.
For example, this is Gustav Klimt. At his work, and you say, which is? I always tell people I have three categories: oh my, and oh my god.
Oh my god.
This and oh my god plus.
Yeah.
And you feel that he had a relationship with Adele Bloch Bauer.
Yeah.
And it took him 4 years to do the picture.
Yeah.
So he must have had a 4-year relationship.
Yeah.
But the fact is that it's probably one of the most powerful pieces. Interesting enough, when the Nazis came in, they seized it. And it stood in the Belvedere for, I guess, almost 50 years, 60 years.
Yeah.
And it wasn't because of Austria's laws, finally. And Maria Altman, who was the niece of the Bloch Bauer family, finally got it out. And it went first to California, then came to Neue Gallery.
You had something to do with that, didn't you?
I had something to do with it, yes. I was way in the back.
Yeah. Where do we stand today? Because one of your concerns has been the restitution of art plundered and stolen by the Nazis.
Right. I call that the last prisoners of World War II. What happened is that the Germans, first of all, when they took art, especially great art, kept very good records.
Yes.
And then the art sort of disappeared into museums and different places. And museums, when they have these things, are very reluctant to open their files and perhaps lose their key pieces. So what happens is a fight. We were pretty much stalemated in Germany until a couple of years ago, the Gerlitt case.
Yeah.
Gerlitt was a art dealer for Jewish stolen property.
For Jewish stolen property.
Yes.
Right.
He did other things, but this was mainly his things. And for some reason, at the end of the war, he was stuck with whatever was left. And then his son took over. And when his son, because of taxes, they found that this whole cache of paintings and drawings and prints and became worldwide. People have estimated as much as $1 billion plus.
And they were all in one location?
All in one location. Or really two locations. But
not on the walls, necessarily.
Not on the walls, yeah. Hidden away. And it was really two locations. But the major one was in Munich. And there's a whole case, and our commission going through piece by piece to see which were stolen, which were not. But then at the same time, the German government reacted, and they're putting together a commission to go into the various museums and look and see what was purchased during the 1940, 19, really 38 to 45. Mm. And the fact is that we don't know what's in German museums. We have a good idea that there's enough art in there. Mm. But many of the museums, particularly the smaller ones, are very didn't want anyone to come in. And this commission is going to investigate each one. We have all the records. Very often, some of these paintings were put not in museums, but on various walls of different agencies, feeling that no one's going to walk in there and see it there. Mm. But it's a painstaking task, but I believe we'll accomplish it. It's in all countries in Europe.
This is the book for the exhibit that is now on at the Neue Gallery. How long will it be there?
It'll be there until, I think, January, early January. Yeah, so. And I think it's going to be one of the most popular shows. On the back, you see another portrait of him.
Yeah.
And it's again, the power of what he's talking about.
What's interesting is that you're head of the World Jewish Council.
Congress,
I mean. And, you know, you've also had a long interest in Eastern Europe.
Yes.
With investments and other things.
Right.
And also in Israel. So there's a lot to talk about at another visit, but I wanted to just catch up on this art. So thank you.
Thank you very much. And please see the show as soon as you can.
I'll be there.
We'll put you in front of the line.
Charlie Rose on Bloomberg Television is brought to you by Boeing, where the drive to build something better inspires us every day.
Some come here to build something smarter. Some come here to build something stronger. Others come to build something faster, something safer, something greener, something the whole world can share. People come to Boeing to do many different things. But it's always about the very thing we do best.
Perceptions change and evolve. In a recent Bloomberg Audience Insights report, more and more IT decision makers evaluated Android as a secure platform for large-scale business operations. In the survey, 72% of IT decision makers said they had deployed an Android device as part of a bring-your-own-device initiative. Among them, more than 9 in 10 had deployed an Android device from Samsung. One reason they trust Samsung Android devices is the Knox security platform. 79% believe Knox is extremely or very useful for application security, with 78% mirroring that sentiment for malware protection. Samsung is in the unique position to offer security that is deeply rooted in hardware and constantly moves forward to help business realize the full potential of mobility.
Tory Burch is here. She is the CEO, chairman, and designer of Tory Burch. It is a fashion and lifestyle company valued at more than $3 billion and present in over 50 countries. President Obama named her an ambassador for global entrepreneurship earlier this year. The initiative seeks to increase the number of successful small businesses in the United States and globally. Elle Magazine writes, if there was a fashion equivalent to the Sheryl Sandberg lean-in movement, it would have to be the Tory Burch working mother, CEO, designer, philanthropist paradigm. Tory Burch, In Color, is her first book. It is a coffee table volume. And here is the trailer for the book.
Or catch a plane to somewhere without rest. Or get the time to know that it does rest. We'll make a path to know it's not today.
Living, you said, is in full cause my guiding principle from the way I raise my children to the way I approach my work. So explain what that means.
You know, I started to think about color in general. Our company has so much color all around. And my parents always taught me to embrace new creative thinking. And that's something we did, accept all kinds of people, use our imagination. And that really ties into our use of color for actually just the visual use of color.
You have 11 colors here, including orange, blue, green, purple, pink, red, yellow, white, black, natural, and gold. Any reason for those colors or any colors admitted that was a runner-up?
Well, some definitely were a given. And then I worked with our feng shui master to help pick the best colors, and we put them in his order as well.
What's the reason for the success of your company, you think?
You know, I think in the beginning we reached, we entered the market and there was a white space. And it was the idea, a very simple idea for me, just designing beautiful things that I love that didn't cost a fortune. And I think when we realized the impact that had, we saw that the space was quite large, this area between contemporary and designer that was open.
Between contemporary and designer.
Yeah, it was sort of this
area. What's that area?
So it's contemporary. We're considered contemporary, designer is much more expensive. So it's sort of...
So you found some way to give a designer's kind of input to contemporary.
Hopefully a designer feel and just not cost designer price point.
What do we need to empower more women?
Well, starting with men, we need to make men part of the conversation.
Yeah, right.
I have three boys.
Yeah,
I know you support.
Yes.
No, I do. I know you support women's issues. I think it's super important. Pay inequity just shouldn't exist. It should be about the quality of work, not about the gender.
Yeah. What's been the hardest thing in terms of your own journey?
I think, you know, gaining confidence to really believe in myself was a big one. I had an article written on our company, the first article, and a great friend called and said, it was a great article, but you shied away from the word ambition.
Yeah.
Which I thought about it. She was absolutely right.
Absolutely.
And I was kind of mad at myself because I was raised with three brothers, not knowing there was a difference in what we could do. Our parents made us believe we could do anything. And then when I really looked at the article and looked at myself, I realized I was a little timid when facing that word. And that's something I would love to change.
Here's what Anna Winter writes about you. Who wouldn't want to be Tori Burch? She's admirable in so many ways. She's charming. She's humble. She's a fantastic mother, devoted friend. She's proven her to be quite simply a truly sensational businesswoman. Does that part of it surprise you, or was that the easiest part of it?
No, it surprises me. I think the whole company surprises me. I set out to do a little store and off the way street in downtown New York, and 5 years, three stores possibly, that was the business plan. But I had big hopes and aspirations. When I hear myself talking about when I was trying to raise money, I said I wanted to start a global lifestyle brand. Yeah. I had no idea what that meant.
But when you say that, you think Ralph Lauren.
Yeah, but it wasn't Ralph. It was just this idea of I knew I wanted to start a foundation. I wanted to be part of the business plan. And then I thought global because women inspire me. It's not just American women.
Were there moments in which you thought, after you had the first store, this is not going to work?
Many moments.
Really?
We were on a great trajectory of growth in the first few years, and that was exciting, and the pace was fast. I had three little boys. You know, it was a lot of balls up in the air, so it was a lot of figuring out. And then clearly I've had some obstacles in the last 10 years.
Right.
Many times.
This is conflict within...
conflict, a divorce,
the family ownership,
all these
divorce,
different
all
things.
Those things
so,
that
said,
is that behind you?
It's totally behind me and everyone. And what I learned about myself is when I face those conflicts, I get more focused, and I don't shy away from it. I sort of face it, and I get stronger. And I had to be a pillar for my company and my family.
Does it leave scars? Does it take a toll?
I don't think so. I mean, I think I'm just this optimist at the end of the day, and I think I'm always trying to make the best of every situation. That said, it was very tough going through it, and really worried.
It was in the papers.
It was worried about protecting my three sons and my stepdaughters and everything around us. So it was tough.
Has the dream changed?
Not at all. Not at all. I often said, I was at an entrepreneur event, one of our mentor events last week, and I said, if you're not dreaming and dreaming big enough, and if it doesn't scare you, you're not dreaming big enough. I do feel I have big dreams.
I guess your reach should exceed your grasp.
It definitely, well, yes, I guess that's true. I want to have impact with women and helping women. I've always wanted to help people. I thought it would be women and children. I realized if we can help women help themselves, it's not a charity.
How do you do that globally?
Well, I think starting with our foundation right here in the U.S. and then expanding it at some point.
But what are you doing on the ground in, pick your place, Asia?
Well, so nothing from our foundation standpoint yet, but we are building our business over there. So, we have high hopes and aspirations.
And are their tastes different than, say, the taste in the United States, or is exciting, pretty,
Yes, we design different things for different markets. That said, the best sellers are the best sellers across the board and similar.
That's interesting because, you know, whether it's Asia or Africa or Europe or Latin America or the United or the North Hemisphere, in the end, the best sellers will sell everywhere.
They will. At the end, it's about the product.
And do you tell me what your role is today? I mean, is it to be the CEO and run the company, or do you have, because of who you are, a closeness to design?
So I, for the last 10 years, have been the designer and CEO, and that's been very different for our industry. It's usually one or the other. I do have that left-right side of the brain, but I love both, and I learned on the job. I surrounded myself with excellent people who had a lot of skills, and I really love the design, but I also love the business. But I, about a month ago, just made an announcement and hired a co-CEO. And
because you want to focus on what?
No, it wasn't because I was looking to fill that role. It was because of the person, and it was this gentleman, Roger Farah, who I have followed and just admired from afar, and made a call and just said, can we have breakfast? And as it turns out, he had just told the place he had been working for the past 10 years that he was leaving. So it was just great
timing.
You know
what I love about that story, not knowing that story? What I love about the story, it is that until you call, you never know. I mean, so will be a time that, I mean, you're still very, very young. Will be a time in which you want to say, you know, I've created this company. This company grows of its own.
It's hard. My passion is really tied into this company. Beyond that, it's my family. It's curiosity, learning things about the world, helping different kinds of people, whether it's our entrepreneurs that are women, but just getting involved and trying to make a difference. But the company is such a passion. I can't really see beyond that.
Yeah. When are you going to design things for men?
Hopefully soon.
Soon?
No, not soon. We don't have a time. Right. One day, and we were talking about you being great muse for me. I hope we never did get to that thing we talked about designing, the bathing suit.
Right, exactly. But when you think about the life that you have, is there something missing at all?
I work very hard. But that said, I also love enjoying vacation a lot. So for me, it's finding that balance. And as we go, I don't really have a set plan. For me, it's just more of the same and until we find new ways of doing it and always evolving the company, always learning myself and pushing in new directions, unexpected ones. So to me, there's not really a set plan in place.
And when the idea of the design comes together, I mean, is it Tori, or is it Tori overseeing a group of people and selecting whatever the best ideas that percolate up from all of them?
I would say it's both. I mean, for sure, I'm involved in setting the ideas.
Right.
And then once I get the inspiration, and definitely I'm involved, sadly, in every single thing that we make, I see and approve. But we have such a talented team, and so I feel very fortunate to be working with such a great thinkers.
Did you once say, I want to create a non-bitchy fashion company?
Yes, I still do.
What's a non-bitchy fashion company?
You know, for me, it's about being straightforward. It's about always knowing where people stand, supporting people, having an environment that really expects great work, but also is a great place to be.
You know, culture is important.
Culture is everything.
Everything. You know, creating a place that maximizes the contribution that people who are part of the enterprise can make.
Well, if you have happy people, they do their best work. It's pretty simplistic.
And how do you do that?
It's a lot of work. It's a trickle-down effect. We talk about it a lot. That said, we do culture surveys. We listen to what people are writing or saying, and it's not easy. I mean, we definitely have work to do, and we always will. But that said, we have 80% participation in these culture surveys, so we have an engaged, maybe out of 2,500 employees, think of that, 80% of them participate in the survey.
Eric Schmidt said about you from Google, there are always limitations when you have an iconic founder, limitations of time and other things. And he says there's only one Tori. So, I mean, I assume the idea as you expand of making sure you have key people.
Yes.
It becomes almost an
necessity.
A necessity and an imperative,
It is, and we do have key people before we hired Roger, and so that's the thing. We have an incredible team, but we are also growing, and I think when you become a different size company, different complexities happen, so we want to be prepared.
It's great to have you at the table.
Thank you, Charlie.
Thank you. Tory Burch. This book is called Tory Burch in Color. As someone who loves color, you see a lot of it here. We'll catch a plane to somewhere with our friends.
Bloomberg Television.
You are watching
Bloomberg Television.
Bloomberg Television.
Did you get that?
I think that the Malaysian government creates a very business-friendly environment. They've been working alongside us throughout the 40 over years. We wouldn't be where we are today without that support. And obviously, that support would continue.
Malaysia is at the forefront of success. We have very talented people, world-class infrastructure, and we provide a very strategic environment for businesses to grow.
Gunderman Group.
Gunderman Group is growing.
Getting in a groove.
Growth is gratifying.
The goal is to grow.
Gotta get greater growth.
I just talked to UPS. They've got expert advice, special discounts, new technologies, like smart pickups. They'll only show up when you print a label, and it's automatic. We save time and money.
Time? Money?
Time and money.
Awesome.
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 Awesome. Awesome.
I love logistics.
Fast, easy execution for corporations and institutions. In over 140 currencies and 200 markets. With sophisticated analytics, award-winning research, advanced risk management, and deep market insights. That's FX Amplified. That's the power of global connections. Bank of America, Merrill Lynch.
How do you start your day so you make better investment decisions?
You watch Bloomberg Surveillance to find out what the markets are doing. And you talk to smart people. Bloomberg Surveillance, weekdays at 6 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Television.
Eliminate your monthly phone bill with Magic Jack. Simply connect your internet and landline phone to Magic Jack to start making crystal clear phone calls. The all-new Magic Jack Go includes 1 year of free digital phone service. Download the free Magic Jack app and your home calls ring on your smartphone. Click or visit Radio Shack today.
I am so glad that Jen set us up.
Yeah.
So how do you guys know each other?
Jen and I went to summer camp together.
Oh, that's cute. Yeah.
You know, I never lost a Maccabi.
Oh, whoa.
I know,
watch
right?
out. What's Maccabi?
Oh, man. I am tired.
You know, I never lost a Maccabi.
Color Wars?
You know what that is?
Yeah, we call it Maccabi, too.
Do you want to go out and grab a drink?
Yes. Do you want to meet my parents?
Ross needs an auditor who knows the industry as well as he does. For Brian, it's whether he can call the partner at midnight.
So?
They both came up with the same name, BDO.
Huh.
People who know BDO.
Some come here to build something smarter. Some come here to build something stronger. Others come to build something faster. Something safer. Something greener. Something the whole world can share. People come to Boeing to do many different things. But it's always about the very thing we do best.
Partnerships occur when both share a passion for improving, for growing in harmony. Speak from the heart and respect the other. A feeling of of being comfortable, of being open, that creates the true partnership, which ensures the greatest success. Together, invest in remarkable Indonesia.
I'm Mark Halperin.
And I'm John Heilman. And with all due respect to Snoop Dogg, who turns 43 today, this is the one where we bring out the gin and juice.
Here's the playlist for tonight's show. Chicago's greatest hits, Caroline on My Mind, and When You Wish Upon a Czar. But first, the spread of Ebola. Summing things up as only he can, here's our 42nd president in North Little Rock, Arkansas, yesterday, with a Clinton Classic tour de force pleading for sanity and framing up the issue.
Now, I have been especially dismayed in the last few days by the way people who don't know a lick about it are frantically trying to fill certain elements of the media in with this blame game over the Ebola crisis. I don't think for a minute that the Republicans in Congress would have denied the World Health Organization the funds they did to organize emergencies or cut back on the NIH's research budget. I'm not out here blaming them.
Now, as Bill Clinton would say, if you see a turtle on a fence post, you know it didn't get there by himself. Clearly, the president's put this in his stump speech because he thinks this is a problem for Democrats that he's trying to play defense on. My question to you is, how big a problem here at the end is Ebola now for Democratic candidates?
Well, it depends on what happens over the coming days, right? We've seen the 40 people who are physically in contact with Michael Eric Duncan, the first Ebola victim. They've all been cleared now, right? If there are no more cases of Ebola in the United States over the course of the next week, this issue could fade very, very quickly. Another Ebola case in the United States 3 or 4 days from now, it could last all the way to Election Day.
There's no question that Democrats and Republicans are picking up in polling, and some of the public polling shows.
Yes,
this is a problem now for Democrats. And even if there are no more cases, it will string out. We're not that far away from Election
Day. Look, right now, one of the most amazing facts in the polling right now is the fact that 65 or so percent of Americans think there's a high likelihood of a major outbreak of Ebola in the United States, which is absurd. There is no chance of a major outbreak of Ebola in the United States, or a very limited chance.
You're calling a majority of the American people absurd.
I'm saying they have been misled if they think there's going to be a major outbreak of Ebola in the United States. And if they start to see the evidence that that's true, this will recede as an issue. If something else happens that drives that fear number higher, Katie bar the door, and it's going to be bad for Democrats and bad for everybody.
Katie bar the door.
I don't even know who Katie is, but I'm going to ask her at bar the door. All right. It's 2 weeks until the midterms, and President Obama is back home in Chicago today, exercising his constitutional franchise and casting an early vote. After pulling the lever, the president visited the campaign office of incumbent Illinois Democratic Governor Pat Quinn and brought along some donuts and juice.
Donuts.
Having fun and looking loose.
I want everybody to know that I just voted. Diane was one of my volunteers back when I was running for the U.S. Senate.
Wow.
Back in the day. So this is like the young hotshot organizer. You guys keep on working now. Don't get distracted. We got stuff to do.
You passed the bar?
Yeah.
Congratulations, man. There's nothing like campaign fever going on.
If you didn't know better, you'd think that was a shot from 2012 Election Day or 2008 Election Day. It's obviously not. It's 2014. The president is not a popular figure in America right now, but there's some polling that suggests that he's actually less of a factor now than he was a month ago. How much of an albatross do you think he is personally for Democrats in the midterms at this point?
He's still a big problem. Look, he's out campaigning some, but not very much. He's right in his home state. I still think the White House is going to have to figure out how they explain that in the home stretch he's not going to these targeted races. So I'm not sure the polling's right that he's less of a factor. He's still the biggest factor, and not in a good way for Democrats.
I think it's a little more complicated, just in the sense that he's a big factor. It's a lot of people have focused on the Ebola thing. It's a whole mass of things. Republicans have done a pretty good job of bundling in the Secret Service and ISIS and Ebola, and started to whip up this sort of sense that America is going to hell in a handbasket, as Fox polled last week. The president is the biggest, most visible symbol for that right now, and it's not going to get better between now and election.
And he's not on the playing field nationally in these key races, talking about minimum wage or these other issues where Democrats do have an advantage. Is leaving it up to these individual candidates. And right now, a lot of them are on the defensive because of the president and not getting a lot of the upside of the Democratic policy.
Of course, is why you see a lot of these Democrats now embracing the travel ban, for instance, because it's a good way for them to distance themselves from Obama without having to push him too far away and worry about depressing turnout among the minority voters and other voters they need to get out on election day.
Embracing the travel ban and embracing Bill Clinton.
And embracing
in some
Bill
places
Clinton,
Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
All right, so on Friday, the president named Ron Klain his Ebola czar, and Republicans wasted no time over the weekend and into today making Mr. Klain a political piñata.
Ron Klain, who is known for being a spinmeister.
Ron Klain, who is a Democrat political hack.
Inside crony
Democrat apparatchik.
White House political operative.
This is a chump. I mean, with all due respect, he is a political hack.
Thanks for the shout out there, Geraldo.
With all due respect to Geraldo, Ron Klain is a very competent guy. We both know him and know he's competent. But was this politically the smart choice for the president to name this guy as Ebola czar?
This is one of these places where I think that the politics have to be secondary to function, right? Ron Klain, what we know about Ron Klain, really smart on policy, really smart on politics, a good communicator, and a really great bureaucratic organizer, infighter, right? That's kind of what this job needs. It's not necessarily optically the best choice, but he's a good choice on the substance for the job.
Here's the three things that are going to be challenged for him. Can he go up to the Hill and calm the waters? I don't think he can because he's a partisan figure and that's not been his strength. Can he go before the public and be commanding in a way that will calm people? It's not what he's done historically. And he does not have the science background. I think having Ron Klain on this effort is great substantively for the president.
Yeah.
I think naming him as the lead czar of the thing was not necessarily the best the president could do because of those deficiencies that he's got.
Well, it certainly by choosing someone who didn't have a public health background, it certainly made him a target for a bunch of other people who don't have any public health backgrounds to criticize the president on that front. And he's not Norman Schwarzkopf. You know, he's not that guy, right? But again, I mean, we've seen this over the years. What President Obama tends to, he didn't want to do this, right? And he wasn't going to do it and do just some flashy thing. Pick someone he's comfortable with and someone who he thinks can actually do the job that needs to be done.
Here's the thing about Ron. He'll do a good job organizing it. Yeah. Not one Democrat that we could found have criticized him. That is a great sign for the White House, because if Democrats were piling on, that'd be a real problem. So far, Democrats are at least quietly supportive of the choice, not critical of it. And as you said before, if this thing goes away and Ron can sort of manage the end game of it, he's a very smart choice.
And anybody who can be the chief of staff for both Al Gore and Joe Biden is a guy who knows how to take on some tough problems.
No question.
Okay. North Carolina is our Senate race to watch today. Democratic incumbent Kay Hagan has held a small but persistent lead in the polling in this contest for months. But now it looks like things may be turning against her. As Bloomberg View's Al Hunt wrote in his column today, quote, the race will probably be decided by whether voters are thinking about their distaste for Obama in Washington or their negative feelings about Republicans in Raleigh. Mark, is Kay Hagan now as endangered as any other at-risk Democrat?
She's not as endangered, but Tom Tillis has the momentum, and at the end you want momentum. Now maybe he'll be peaking too early,
right,
but she has been put somewhat on the defensive. This race has got hundreds, tens of millions of dollars spent on it. She has been battered, and now Republicans have the feeling that Tillis has gotten up to the level where he deserves to be supported financially. It's going to be much more equal down the home stretch than it's been.
I believe it's about $100 million. I think it's going to be the highest per capita spending on a Senate race this year. At least people are projecting that. She is the problem. Her weakness now, in addition to the things being thrown at her on ISIS and Ebola and the kind of unraveling of America, the key voting groups she really needs to win with are ones where the president is having problems with, right? He's not going to be able to get there to help her with African-American voters because he's not going to go to North Carolina. Women voters, he's suddenly doing really badly with women voters. Those are the pillars of her winning in this race, and they are suddenly being eroded underneath her.
Tillis is at the peak of his performance. We'll see how he does. We're going to talk more about this race a little bit later in the show.
Our next guest is such a big deal that we made him our honored guest. Andrew Cuomo takes our questions until he runs out of time when we come back.
Bloomberg's With All Due Respect is brought to you by Koch Industries. Learn more at KochCareers.com.
Koch Industries started in the heartland, and we've expanded to nearly every state. Today, that's more than 60,000 American jobs. You may not always see our name on the products you use, but we help make better food, clothing, shelter, technologies, and other necessities. Here, we build on each other's ideas to create more opportunities for people everywhere. Together, we are Coke.
Perceptions change and evolve. In a recent Bloomberg Audience Insights report, more and more IT decision makers evaluated Android as a secure platform for large-scale business operations. In the survey, 72% of IT decision makers said they had deployed an Android device as part of a bring-your-own-device initiative. Among them, more than 9 in 10 had deployed an Android device from Samsung. One reason they trust Samsung Android devices is the Knox security platform. 79% believe Knox is extremely or very useful for application security, with 78% mirroring that sentiment for malware protection. Samsung is in the unique position to offer security that is deeply rooted in hardware and constantly moves forward to help business realize the full potential of mobility.
Only Bloomberg Television has the interviews you want to hear.
One of the fascinating things about Twitter is that once you get it, it becomes indispensable to you.
My eyes, we're all created equal.
Online, on your tablet, and on your phone. Bloomberg Television, wherever you are.
We've both wanted to interview Andrew Cuomo, the governor of New York, for quite a while. But on his book tour last week, he talked on TV to Charlie Rose and David Letterman. That was pretty much it. So we did two things this morning that we rarely do. We attended an event about infrastructure, and we went to Queens. After that event, as part of a classic Gotham City press gaggle, a.k.a. cluster forget about it, we asked the governor about the political impact of the Ebola crisis and how he thinks the Obama administration has handled things.
Governor, do you have a sense of how Ebola is affecting the electorate, whether your party could be at all hurt in the midterms by it?
I don't feel that here. I think Ebola runs into the same issue we were talking about in some ways. You know, you have a schizophrenia right now, or you have two competing tensions. Lack of confidence in government, lack of belief in government. Washington is gridlocked. They can't get anything done. They can't pass a budget. Oh, my gosh, Ebola, which now calls for a superior level of competence. By the way, ISIS, terrorism, a superior level of competence. And I think what you're seeing is that lack of confidence experientially now running into a real anxiety about a problem that only government can handle, right? Well, we don't need government. Yeah, we don't need government. Okay, how do we handle Ebola? How do we handle terrorism? How do we rebuild airports, right?
Do you think the federal response has been handled well?
You know, it's not my field. I'm a lawyer, and I like to sort of stay in what I know or stay far away from something that I have no idea about. I have been doing the work getting New York prepared for Ebola, and I can tell you we've never been here before. And they make it sound easy on the television. Just follow the protocol and everything is fine. These are very specific and strict protocols, much more specific and strict than most of the preparation thus far. You only get one slip, one mistake. And remember, even if you do everything right from the point of identification, you're then left with the issue of everyone who was in contact with that person up until then. So you then have a whole detective game of manhunt, person hunt. Where were they? Who touched them? Who did they see? So it really is a phenomenal, challenging situation. I do not see any partisan or political divide or commentary about it. I don't get that.
So he just done an event with Joe Biden before came and talked to the press. And yet, when I asked him how the federal government was doing, he said, I'm a lawyer.
It's not my field. Right. I'm a lawyer. He also spent a long time not saying the following words. Barack Obama's doing a great job managing this federal government. It's, you know, it's obviously disturbing that we've had a couple cases in the United States, but by and large, what I've seen from the federal government has been excellent, and they've done a great job. I could answer that question just that fast.
And he's a guy cruising to re-election in a blue state.
Yes.
And again, just had spent the morning with Joe Biden. So it shows you his fingertip feels a lot of Democrats, which is right now saying the president's doing a great job. The polls don't think the president and the administration are doing a great job. Yes. Not the safest place to be.
Yes, and funny that he started it by saying, I don't really think there's a big political issue in New York on this, but I'm now going to tap dance around it in the most politically neutralizing way possible.
Exactly. All right, we're going to listen to a little bit more of our talk with Governor Cuomo here.
Governor, sorry, can you talk about the in the context of a time when public doesn't have a lot of trust in government? These are expensive projects you're talking about. How do you build the kind of broad-based public support? The public says, yeah, please spend our tax dollars on these big things.
If you look at New York, you have to say, boy, these are people who really love to build, and they are a bold, aggressive people. Longest bridge, longest underground subway, water tunnels that go from New York City to the Hudson Valley to bring down water. And then something happened where it just all stopped. And you're not building. And I think it comes back to the confidence in government. And government is going to build. You know what happens when government builds. It's going to be over time. It's going to be on over budget. It's going to be waste. It's going to be fraud. I don't believe in our government. And therefore, I don't believe in our government's capacity to build.
So how does that get restored?
Not with a speech, not with words, but by showing competence. Proving competence. Show them that you can do it. Show them that you can stop this political bickering and the gridlock and the Democrats and the Republicans and all this nonsense. That makes zero difference in their life, by the way. And show that you're actually competent, that you value a dollar, you're not going to waste their money, you're efficient, you're effective, and get it done.
From a personal and political point of view, how will you judge your success on Election Day?
51.
You'll be totally happy with 51?
51. These are complicated times. There are a lot of issues on that ballot that have nothing to do with the personalities on that ballot. We have fracking on the ballot. We have Common Core on the ballot. There's no doubt that there's a Washington overlay to all of this. So there's a lot beyond, you know, most elections are about people. And it's a competition between two people. I think this is a far more complex election than that. And 51 is 51. Well, margins and this. I defy even you, political genius, a year after an election to remember what the margin was. You know, I don't remember my margin as governor or as attorney general. It doesn't matter. 51, and then do the job.
All right, I don't want to put you in a position of calling the governor of New York a liar, but you think he really doesn't know what the margins are, and you think he'd be happy with 51?
I think there's a reasonable chance that that Andrew Cuomo could go back to his father's reelection campaigns and remember what his father's margin was, four numbers to the right of the decimal place. That's what I think.
What was interesting about that?
But I think 51 would be bad for him. He'd be crushed. Yeah, if he
doesn't talk to national reporters very often, right, particularly on TV. You heard both, to borrow his father's line, you heard both poetry and prose there.
Yeah.
He's very proud of his record as governor.
Sure.
At the same time, he does like to try to reach for that loftier rhetoric when he's talking about what it takes to restore trust in government, what kind of governor he's been.
And he's making this case for, it's very neoliberal, and like his father, very much paleoliberal, this kind of case that is, I believe in government, but government must work for people. About competence, and it's almost a weird, there's a Dukakis thing to it. You know, this is like, you can imagine if he ever does venture run for president, this is the platform he's building, which is, I made New York work,
exactly,
and that served the liberal goals of my father and my forebears in the party.
Yep, exactly.
All right. Coming up, how frantically are those Democrats scrambling in North Carolina? We dispatched the great and glorious Albert Reinhold Hunt Jr. on a boondoggle to Tar Heel State to find out. Bogdale.
Bloomberg's With All Due Respect is brought to you by BP, proud to be America's largest energy investor.
When folks think about what they get from Alaska, they think salmon and energy. But the energy BP produces up here creates something else as well. Jobs all over America. Engineering and innovation jobs, advanced safety systems and technology, shipping and manufacturing. Across the United States, BP supports more than 250,000 jobs. When we set up operation in one part of the country, people in other parts go to work. That's not a coincidence. It's one more part of our commitment to America.
This is the cat that drank the milk and let in the dog that woke the man who drove to the control room.
Driverless mode engaged.
Find parking space.
Parking space found.
That secured the data, that directed the turbines, that powered the farm, that made the milk, that went to the store, that reminded the man to buy the milk, that was poured by the girl who loved the cat. The Internet of Everything is changing everything. Cisco, tomorrow starts here.
Breitling, instruments for professionals.
Bloomberg View's Al Hunt joins us now because there is no baseball and certainly no Nationals baseball to watch today. He's got plenty of time to wow us with his wit and wisdom. Let's get right to it, Al. Tell us what you think is going on in that North Carolina Senate race.
I think that North Carolina Senate race is one of the great negative races in the country in a year full of negative races. It's whether you like Raleigh or whether you hate Raleigh more or you hate Washington more. Kay Hagan, the incumbent senator, is running against Tom Tillis, the Speaker of the House. And really what I think she's done fairly effectively is to say, hey, you may not like Washington, but look what they did in Raleigh. Tillis's hope in the last couple weeks, the last couple days in particular, but the last couple weeks of the campaign, is that ISIS and Ebola, while they're not in the forefront of people's minds down there, will just make people think about how dysfunctional and incompetent Washington is.
Yeah.
Right now, slight edge to Kay Hagan.
Al, do you agree, though, that Tillis is the one who has the momentum now? And is that because of circumstances, or is he running a better campaign than he was before?
The Republicans say that he has the momentum. The Democrats say their private polling does not show that. It's been a rather steady three-point advantage. I've talked to some Republicans who actually say Tillis has moved not only even, maybe even a point or two ahead. I think he's gotten his act together a little bit better. He was really disadvantaged, Mark, for so long because that state assembly had to stay in office through much of the summer. And I think that was a real problem for him. He's certainly gotten better the last couple weeks. Still, it's going to be tough. 95% of the people have made up their mind.
Now, we talked earlier about how expensive this race is. And, you know, there's obviously been a ton of money spent across the country in these contested races. This race looks like it might be the most expensive per capita. Why did this race, among all the dozen or so big races, why did this one become the focus for so much money?
I think early on, the Republicans saw a tremendous advantage here. They thought that Tillis could win the primary. He was much stronger than the right-wingers he beat in that primary. And that secondly, they had a real party infrastructure down there, and that Kay Hagan was vulnerable. She was not a particularly renowned senator, and that they could beat her. She's proven to be more resilient, tougher than they thought. And she's raised a heck of a lot of money. Money will not decide this race. They both have ample amounts of money, including from outside sources.
As we've discussed, one of the distinctive things about this race is the education issue, always a big issue in North Carolina, and one that the Hagan folks have really elevated, trying to talk about Tillis and government spending on education with he was speaker. Has that issue been diluted? Is that still what Hagan's trying to drive?
Well, she's talked more the last couple of days about women's issues and pay equity and defunding Planned Parenthood. They all of the piece of a piece in the sense that it is all against what the Republicans did in Raleigh. Tillis, of course, claims they really didn't cut education. And if you look at the figures, they didn't, except it didn't keep pace with population growth and inflation. So it really was a cut. It probably resonates more as an issue in that state than any other state this year.
You mentioned that Senator Hagan's been leaning on these women's issues recently, and it seems natural to me that she would, given what we started to see in this polling in the last few days about how President Obama, though the gender gap seeming to narrow, particularly as you see President Obama's numbers with women, in particular subsets of women, starting to kind of not collapse, but certainly ebb. Is she feeling that in a direct way there, that her, I mean, she needs those women voters, those suburban women voters, to win this race. Is she starting to see some deterioration there?
John, I saw her in Charlotte on Friday. And she didn't at that point. There's obviously a worry about Obama. She doesn't talk about the president a great deal, no right. great surprise. But what they calculate is that they know they're going to turn out the African-American vote they right. need. They feel very confident of that, in large part because of negativity towards Republicans. They are worried about getting that percentage of the white votes in the high 30s that they need, and that goes to the issue you just raised. But as of Friday, at least, they were rather confident they could achieve that.
So
The other thing to point out is she doesn't need 50. She probably needs 47 or 48. There's a Libertarian candidate who is a pizza delivery guy, and he's polling as high as 6-7% in the polls.
We need more pizza delivery people in the Congress. The president, in the last 2 weeks, it looks they're still saying, we still don't know his full schedule, but today Josh Earnest was saying, well, look, there's a lot going on in the world, so it's not so surprising the president's off the trail. As we get down to the last week, will it be a problem, more of a problem for Democrats to have to deal with him not on the trail and the symbolism of that, or more of a problem if he is on the trail in some of these contested and less contested races and becoming more of a part of the news cycle?
I don't think in Georgia or North Carolina or some other hotly contested places they're going to lament the fact that Barack Obama can't find time in his schedule to be there, Mark. He'll be making calls, robocalls, to particularly African-American voters, but I don't think the president is a welcome sight on most campaign trails. Went to Maryland, go to Illinois, but not very many places.
But you think they're looking for opportunities to say, hey, there's a crisis, he's got to stay home from at the White House?
Sure. Sure, I think that's a good reason to do that, because I don't think he's welcome in a lot of places. Look, he is in North Carolina, which he only lost by a little bit last time, carried in 08. His popularity, his favorability is about 35%. If you're Kay Hagan, you don't want someone in there who had 35%, particularly when your opponent links everything to you and Obama.
Al, we only got a few seconds left. Just really, really quick. I don't want to rub salt in your wounds anymore, but who you got in this World Series?
I think your Giants are probably going to win it, John.
Okay.
That's short good. Series, long series.
I think it'll go six games.
Right. All right. Okay. You're on record.
Al Hunt of Bloomberg All View. Right. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you, Jack.
And we'll be right back.
A remote that lives on your phone. More Wi-Fi in more places. A movie library you can take wherever you go. Internet speeds that have gotten faster 13 times in 12 years. At Comcast, we're creating new possibilities. Together with Time Warner Cable, we'll be able to extend those to more people. Comcast and Time Warner Cable. Together is better for more people.
Go ahead and put your bag right here. Have a nice flight.
Entire company who knows that the most on-time flights are nothing if we can't get your things there too. It's no wonder more people choose Delta than any other airline.
Gunderman Group.
Gunderman Group is growing.
Getting in a groove.
Growth is gratifying.
Goal is to grow.
Gotta get greater growth.
I just talked to UPS. They've got expert advice, special discounts, new technologies, like smart pickups. They'll only show up when you print a label, and it's automatic. We save time and money.
Time? Money?
Time and money.
Awesome.
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 Awesome. Awesome.
I love logistics.
Coke Industries started in the heartland, and we've expanded to nearly every state. Today, that's more than 60,000 American jobs. You may not always see our name on the products you use, but we help make better food, clothing, shelter, technologies, and other necessities. Here, we build on each other's ideas to create more opportunities for people everywhere. Together, we are Coke.
We are only on the air a half hour a day, but we are live 24-7 on BloombergPolitics.com. Go and check out the website and read Annie Alinsky's great story about Elizabeth Warren and what she is actually up to in her campaigning efforts.
Also, lots of coverage on BloombergPolitics.com on the politics of Ebola. We'll be back tomorrow, and Taking Stock is coming up now on Bloomberg TV.
partnerships occur when both share a passion for improving, for growing in harmony. Speak from the heart and respect the other. Feeling of being comfortable, of being open, that creates the true partnership, which ensures the greatest success.